Hello and welcome to episode 18 of Long Shots, our weekly podcast where we like to discuss business and finance and pretty much anything that we find interesting, intriguing, and relevant. We are streaming live on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, and pretty much any podcast app that you have and you like. So do subscribe to our channel so that you get that nice little notification every time we shoot an episode. I have with me Sharad Tupran and this is Nikhil. Hi, Sharad.
Hi, Nikhil. How are you? It's always a pleasure to be here and chat up with you and reflect back on what's happening in the world of news in the last 1 week. So looking forward again.
Yeah, this week has been very, very busy news-wise, right? I mean, in India, overseas, across the corporate spectrum, macro, geopolitical soap operas, I don't know what not.
Yeah, there's plenty of drama. Don't need too many TV shows and drama TV shows. If you just consume news, I think you'll get your source of entertainment and thrill.
Yeah, at least we get it through that only,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of first things first, I recall we were both looking at the Jet Airways share price chart.
Yeah,
for the last 15 years.
Yeah, it's outstanding, isn't it?
Yeah, I do invite all our listeners to Google Jet Airways share price and put the filter for Max,
yeah.
So that they can see how it has moved since the company went public. What was the observation you had, Sharad, when you saw that?
Probably one of the worst looking charts I've ever seen.
Yeah, why do you say that?
Because it does nothing to me in terms of making money.
Yeah.
Either take a short position or a long position. You just can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
It's an obnoxiously volatile chart, which does nothing. Probably presents you multiple entry and exit points, but without any warning signs, right? So you don't even know what you're getting into.
Correct.
I'd never be a shareholder.
So yeah, just for the benefit of our listeners, I think what Sharad implies is that, I mean, in finance being, what do you call it, a range-bound chart.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you look at it, I mean, I'll obviously add the tweet in our description today for you guys to enjoy it, but basically, it goes up, it goes down, it goes up again, it goes down again, and the max and the min across 15 years is pretty much the same level.
Yeah.
So as a value investor, which a lot of people would aspire to become, I don't think there's anything there.
There's nothing in there. And it was up, what, 15% in the last 2 days for I don't know what,
yeah.
Whatever reason. I mean, there are reasons which we can briefly talk about. But yeah, like you said, it's not the best chart I've seen in the world.
Yeah, and I'm wondering why it took so long for the promoter, Mr. Goyal, to be forced to step down. It kind of says a lot about the lack of minority shareholder activism in our country.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting can of worms that I don't know if you want to open right now or not, but obviously there was some news around it as well. I think that's, like you say, like minority shareholders have a very important role in maintaining efficient capital markets.
Yeah.
Definitely that piece seems to be much more missing in the Indian context than I've
right.
seen in the Western world.
I guess because in the Indian context, the minority shareholders are pretty much the non-family shareholders, right?
Yeah, non-promoters, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that kind of, obviously, there's a principal agency problem there.
Yeah.
And but yeah, I mean, did you know Mr. Goyal has a nice fancy place in London?
I've heard about it. And you've obviously been in London, so maybe it's more topical or people talk about it. But I've never seen or anything like that.
I was just using this as a crafty segue to go into our next topic, which is related to the UK.
Oh, yeah. UK is probably is making headlines in every country's newspapers, I would suspect, the last
right.
2 days. Just
right.
because of the drama element, but also because of the magnitude of what's happening there in terms of Brexit and lack of Brexit, deal, no deal. And Theresa May obviously is at the very center of everything. So what's going on? Let's talk the two events on consecutive days.
Yeah.
Obviously interlinked.
Yeah, so beginning of the week, the Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, she put her Brexit proposal in the parliament for a vote and she lost spectacularly 433 to 202.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was immediately followed up by a no confidence motion tabled against her by the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah.
Which I think she scraped through overnight. Overnight Indian Standard Time. I think she survived the no confidence motion 325 to 306.
Yeah.
Which obviously is, I think, the lesser of the two evils. If she would have lost the no confidence motion, that would have meant a general election.
Yeah.
And post general election, if a new proposal was tabled and approved before 29th of March.
For which magic needs to happen.
Really, because I think for the last 2 years, nothing has happened in that with that level of mobilization.
Yeah, when did the referendum take place? 2016, right?
Yeah, it was 2016.
2016, we're in 2019 now. Right. And they've come one full circle and now they're talking about probably another referendum. I mean, I don't know if it'll happen or not. But what has happened? They know what doesn't work, but yeah. I don't know if they still know what would work.
Yeah, I think it's a quintessentially British treatment of the problem. You know, like I'm pretty sure in the last 2.5-3 years, everybody knows what doesn't work.
Yeah.
But yeah, they are, I think, still struggling to, you know, kind of build a consensus around what can work. Well, the options are, I mean, it's a fairly complex topic. And yeah. I think the biggest problem there was asking people about such a complex topic directly. But okay, that is in the past, so let that be.
Yeah.
But I think the next steps are on coming Monday. The PM is now supposed to come with the new approach that would be adopted, and it can range from renegotiating with the European Union to come up with like a version 2 of the proposal,
yeah.
and then tabling it in the parliament. Another option is that they can go for a second referendum, which again is probably not an ideal solution, because the options that are suspected to be granted to the citizens would be, do you want a no Brexit, do you want a no deal, or do you want Theresa May's deal?
Yeah.
It's a very difficult question, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. It's hard for non-experts to even argue or address such a thing, right? And
right.
I guess it's perfect. It's such congenial environment for traders to make money because,
yeah.
I mean, the pound ran up. I mean, after the first one, I don't know what happened after Theresa May's no confidence survival, but such and so many.
When she lost the Brexit vote, the pound shot up,
yeah.
But then after that, it's kind of range bound, like Jet Airways stock.
That's a very interesting comparison, though.
Right. And in terms of, I think the biggest bone of contention in Theresa May's proposal was the Irish backstop. So that's the one which needs to be resolved in any renegotiated deal. Otherwise, I mean, basically May's proposal was pretty much saying that we'll continue to stay within the common economic area till we know better. That was pretty much the summary of her plan.
Yeah.
And no wonder on both sides of, on the left and on the right, there's a lot of noise against that. Actually, Jeremy Corbyn, after May lost her vote and when she won the no confidence vote, and May was saying that, you know, coming Monday, we are going to take the new approach. And meanwhile, I would like to invite all stakeholders to give your views, blah, blah, blah. And Corbyn said that, okay, but I want you to clearly lay out that there's not going to be a no deal Brexit.
Yeah.
And that May cannot kind of agree to, because there are a lot of hardliners in her own party, right?
Yeah. No, it's a mess. It's such a complicated. There's so many layers of uncertainty and complications.
Right.
I feel like corporates and banks and financial institutions also should be involved in this discussion and not just merely leave it politicians or referendums, because it's such a layered discussion.
Right. But yeah, I mean, I think probably less. I feel that, a bit of autocratic behavior can't harm in such a situation as well.
No, I agree.
I generally am a great admirer of the government of India in this regard. When they have to really get something done, they can mobilize things very, very quickly and they just don't care.
Yeah.
So probably something like that is also, required on off, because someone has to just take a decision and take the blow.
Yeah, no, I agree. Referendum is we've talked about it in the past and how I think it doesn't work when the subject is so complicated and it's got such layers of technicalities.
Yeah, but with that behind, there has to be someone in the political leadership who just kind of... But the British system or the US system with its checks and balances obviously makes that incredibly challenging.
Yeah.
Even in India, it's supposed to be incredibly challenging. Yeah. But in India, the issues are different.
Yeah,
so I guess often our politicians can get fairly brash, which often works in their favor and often it doesn't. And that way it's... I was actually... Who was it? I forgot. A friend of mine, he was telling me that a metaphorical way of looking at decision-making in India, especially political decision-making in India, is that it's like a big rock, on the top of a cliff. it's very heavy, it's very difficult to move, so a lot of effort is required to, you know, build that inertia. But once it moves, it's really snowballs and speeds up.
That's so, pretty interesting. I like that, actually.
Yeah. So look at us. We are totally in admiration mode for our own country today. Well, in terms of, I don't think we're going to talk about India too much today, though. We are going to talk about our neighborhood next, right? No, we will talk about India, but in the end. But before that, let's step on to China. Plenty of things going on there. I'm obviously not speaking of economics yet. Why don't you start off and feed us in?
Yeah, it's a plot for a Spielberg movie, I think, in future. Well, you know, I mean, the latest drama coming out of it is that there's a Canadian gentleman by the name of Robert Schellenberg,
right.
36 years old, who was, I think, arrested in 2014 for smuggling 222 kgs of methamphetamine, or meth.
Right.
And he was, I think, then put in jail for 15 years or something. But now, abruptly, he's been sentenced to death.
Right.
And obviously, there are reactions from Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. There's also reaction from Australian government on why this suddenly he's being death sentenced. Now, obviously, the story is, like you would be well aware, is that this follows what happened earlier couple of months back on Vancouver when Huawei's senior board member and Meng Wanzhou was arrested.
CFO,
yes.
Right.
She was arrested. So this seems like there is a sense of undertone of retaliation.
So she was arrested on a US warrant in Canada.
In Vancouver, correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And she's got houses there as well.
Right.
Yeah, we've sort of talked about it, but you know, in a summary short version of it is that there are concerns in the global economic or financial world or political world that Huawei devices have some backdoor which helps it in spying on other countries or whoever's using the device, and Huawei is made inroads into US, Canada, Australia, even in India.
Right.
So there were concerns about its safety and all that. So on that ground, she was arrested. But this sort of comes back and seems like it's a retaliation to that. That's what's going on, but let's see how that unfolds. But it's certainly very dramatic.
It's kind of also falling under the entire US-China trade war dynamic, right? Where I guess semiconductor chips are now set to be a new frontier for technological expertise, right? Especially with AI, with machine learning, and semiconductor chips actually being the back-end architecture which holds those technologies together, right?
Yeah, a lot of coverage on that. I think you were telling me about an article you read in Economist, was it?
Right. And they say that the entire Huawei CFO arrest is pretty much a kind of a geopolitical spat between US and China. US is trying to obviously put China in its place by doing these things, especially on a foreign soil.
Yeah.
And but China's obviously facing the heat because of that on multiple fronts, right? I was also reading that they recently announced like almost $300 billion of tax cuts, tariff cuts, in order to, you know, boost their economy, which is really facing a slowdown thanks to the trade issues with the US. But I also read that the father of the Huawei CFO, he made a statement, right?
Yeah, he made a very...
he's the founder, right?
He's the founder, former military, Chinese military.
Right.
And obviously there's a concern that Huawei is run by or founded by a former military guy with communist allegiances. So there is, and Chinese firms are typically answerable to the government if they're asked for. So there's obviously complication. I see the concern.
Right.
And he made a statement saying that first he, I think, appreciated the way his daughter, the CFO Meng Wanzhou, is being treated in the Canadian home arrest setup.
Right.
He's saying, "I'm pleased that she's being taken care of nicely."
No wonder.
That's, but he
compared
also,
to things back home for him.
Yeah. And he also said that he has a lot of respect for President Donald Trump, and that he's never tried to spy on anyone else, any other country, or that's never been a mandate. It's not something that he would do, or he obviously very clean chit, humble, diplomatic kind of commentary.
Right.
I'm sure there are tons of people working on that exact statement, including himself. But I mean, it's just a very defensive statement.
Right.
I guess you got to take that undertone, right, when your daughter's sitting in the Western jail. But
right.
I guess sort of suggesting that it's gone out of proportion. I'm not working with the Chinese government. There is no military angle to it. It's just a device. We don't spy. There are no backdoors. All that things. But yeah,
right.
Those are words that we don't know. Maybe
yeah.
They're true. Maybe they're not.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, if you can't really blame the US also. I mean, I'm pretty sure that it's exaggerated from their end as well. But considering there's a lot of state capital which has gone in Huawei,
yeah.
I assume, and the founder has close allegiance to the Communist Party. Like anyone in power in China, you kind of end up being close to the party, right? Otherwise, you really cannot rise beyond that level.
Yeah.
But yeah, if that has been happening in a structured way, who knows?
And they invest massively in R&D.
Yeah.
They've ticked it up in recent times.
Mm.
That's whole the image of Huawei has changed from being like a sort of a low-key smartphone kind of a player to a real, like you said, hub of R&D for semiconductors and new age machine learning and AI. So they're sort of going the very premium R&D heavy
yeah.
technical route. So that sort of gets alarm bells ringing as well.
Right. In terms of, 222 kilograms of meth, that's also a big quantity, right? I mean, I get it that I don't even know how he was storing it, but okay, let's leave that aside.
Yeah.
But I think the random thing is obviously the 15-year to a death penalty. But I'm pretty sure the defense of Mr. Schellenberg might be arguing that the 222 kilogram story is also fake.
Yeah, he's saying this never happened. What is this? Like, his lawyers are arguing rather that two defense
right.
attorneys, they're saying that this is all fake. Like, there's nothing like that has happened. So who knows? I mean, this is makes for good storytelling, but who knows what's happening?
But if he was arrested in 2014, that time there was no anti-Western dynamic there, right? Why would they just...
Yeah, I know. Those are interesting points. I mean, really have to dig this up in detail. And I honestly haven't gone back that far. But yeah, that's a good point. I mean, he must have been arrested on some grounds.
Some grounds, yeah. right. Anyways, in terms, we can discuss all of that. But,
Or wait for the movie.
Or wait for the movie, exactly. Wait for the movie. And I think that I prefer that route.
Yeah.
Definitely. Speaking of movies, Sharad, very nice. I think the next on our checklist was our homegrown hero, Hotstar.
Yeah.
Who has unleashed 120 crore watches to get into... original program and you called it, right? You called it like a couple of months back that they would have to do something on those lines. Otherwise, they are just at too much at risk.
Yeah. And we both discussed it on one of these episodes as well on how their business risk profile is higher just because they have very little exposure to original programming.
Right.
So
how does, for the benefit of the listeners, what's Hotstar's content model so far?
It's basically three things. One is live sports, which is unique in the Indian circuit.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I think, fairly unique in the world as well.
Mm-hmm.
So live sports, especially with all the rights they've accumulated for IPL and India's cricket series, their EPL, football, tennis, that's one aspect to it. The second aspect is distribution rights for HBO programming in India. So
right.
call it Game of Thrones or True Detective or whatever, HBO content, they're the exclusive distributors here. And HBO doesn't sell its programming to Amazon Prime or Netflix. So Hotstar, again, is the exclusive distributor. So it builds it credibility. And you know how big Game of Thrones and things like that are in India. So that's second. And third is because of its Star India ownership, it gets catch-up content of all Star channels.
Right.
So those are the three things that it's built its value proposition on. Sports being very important. But these are all subject to rights. I mean, HBO, Fox, Disney, Fox. I mean, what if they decide to not extend it to Hotstar? What if, I mean, they're partial owners of it, but what if they decide to go their own OTT route? That's a risky thing. What about cricket rights? I mean, they have to bid for rights every 4 or 5 years or whatever the term is. What if those rights go to a... Like, last time, Facebook also bid for rights.
Right.
So what if they go to someone else, the rights for sports? Then all of a sudden, the value proposition drops for Hotstar.
Right.
So it's a classic defense mechanism.
Because I mean, I guess there are practically no barriers to entry when it comes to distribution or rights if you have the capital.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like,
so it no wonder becomes a at-risk proposition because they don't really are held accountable or they don't own any of the content themselves.
Yeah.
So unless they are able to renegotiate those deals at the right terms.
Yeah.
They are obviously in trouble, and that's why they are kind of going the Netflix route now.
Yeah, exactly. What Netflix did back in the day when they started redistributing movie titles and content, they realized that this is not sustainable.
Yeah, so Netflix also started as a distributor.
Exactly, right? And they realized that this is not going to happen, so let's invest in original programming. And then came House of Cards.
Yeah.
That was a big success.
But they probably started 20 years back, so it kind of, obviously, they had that first mover advantage.
First mover, and now everyone knows the game. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you ask a senior executive of Disney, or they'll tell you that we actually helped them build their brand. Mm-hmm. And then Netflix, like classic move, right, of building your brand using other people's content,
right,
but at the same time on the back burner start investing in content, so that one day people will pull content out of your platform. So let's wait for that to happen, but before that, let's start building original programming so people are already hooked to it. And there is no better endorsement to suggest how good their original programming is by the fact that they just raised their prices,
right,
in arguably one of the most competitive OTT landscapes in the world. They've raised the price. So
yeah, they went up by like almost like what, 15-18%, right?
Yes, correct. 13-18%, yes.
And I mean, the jury is still out on how the price rise impacts them, correct?
Yes, correct. I mean, let's see how if churn shows up.
Yeah.
But another way to think about it, I mean, you tell me what your thoughts are about this, is like they're so confident in their programming that by raising prices, a consumer will cut off from other OTT platforms because they cannot do without Netflix.
Yeah.
So they're like, my Netflix bill is going up. So you know what? I'm not going to afford a Prime now, or I'm not going to be able to afford a HBO OTT or something like that.
I mean, in the Indian context, if you ask me, if they spike up like 10% or 15%, I would continue with them. And it helps that now we also have a kind of a bouquet style offering on our regular TV.
Correct.
Right,
yeah.
Which is coming in from, I think, end of Jan.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've already done that exercise. Yeah. And my bill there has dropped by almost 50% because I have chucked out a lot of irrelevant stuff that I was not viewing.
That's
already enhanced my share of wallet, right?
Yeah.
So, even if Netflix kind of spikes it up by 15%, I'm not going to cut the cord there.
Yeah. I mean, this is, we'll see how inelastic Netflix subscribers are now. Mm. And your channel unbundling, which is happening in India by regulation, it already happened in US organically.
Right.
And it happened in Canada as well 2-3 years back, again, by government mandate. But this channel unbundling is happening, and it's obviously tied to how Netflix thrives. But you're right. I mean, ultimately, it's wallet share.
Yeah.
No one's going to buy $12, $13 products, 10 of those.
Yeah.
They will pick and choose. Mm-hmm. I think Netflix deep down believes that, guys, we are in it.
Yeah.
The time to kill competition is by raising your own price.
Yeah.
So that people go off other subscribers. And
because the going is really good for them right now.
Because it's going. So it might be a shrewd move that way.
I totally agree. I mean, it's a very data-driven company,
yeah,
right? I mean,
yeah,
they must have seen the user behavior. They must have seen that people hook onto Netflix and are, you know, spending considerable amount of time on it every day.
Yeah.
And they realize that. They realize the value proposition. And they are confident that they are now in for so many years. I mean, a lot of customers are not really new customers. They are customers which have been, you know, streaming from Netflix for the past couple of years.
Yeah.
And they know that they're not going to go away anywhere. And I mean, at the end of the day, like, I mean, considering, you know, iPhone 10 sells for $1,000 and people still buy it.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the entire brand proposition always has a very soft but very influential role.
Yeah. And they sort of encourage sharing also, right? So that people who are efficient that way, they share their accounts.
Right.
Another thing, I mean, again, free cash flow discussion, I mean, at some point of time, they'll start have to making free cash flow.
Right.
I mean, one way to do is to raise prices because they are not going to stop investing in content. And as simple as that, right? I mean, from our very simplistic EBITDA minus CapEx kind of perspective, CapEx is not going down at all.
Right.
So they have to inflate their margins.
$8 billion?
I think so. Original programming, $8 and then to, like, it's been going up sequentially, right? It's definitely high single digit or 12, was it? I don't know, but it's significantly high. 8 at the very least, 8 billion on a yearly basis, or towards content. Got to sometime turn around.
But that way, I think a Hotstar is in a difficult spot, right? I mean, they are operating, they are not diversified like Netflix. They are operating solely in India. And now they're getting into original programming, and that's going to cost, right? And that's going to kind of put some sort of I assume right now their predominant revenue stream is from advertising, right? I mean,
yeah,
they have a freemium or something, but
yeah,
probably the wallet share is much bigger from ads.
Yeah, I don't know if it's much bigger, but could be. But yeah, it is freemium. And
at least in terms of margins, I'm guessing.
Yeah, in terms of margin, I think ad would be higher. And there is obviously two tiers of subscription as well. And there's one sports-only package as well, which I think a lot of people subscribe. I don't know how many, definitely 100 million subscribers now.
Right.
So they're definitely making the right noise. But you're right, it's not easy. Content, it's not easy to just have cash and build content and thrive, because Netflix is not making any free cash flow. I mean, you understand if this is one of the biggest players who has the confidence of raising prices in such a competitive environment is also not making any free cash flow, then it is competitive. It's not easy business. And it's also hits and flops driven, right? There will be shows that will bomb. There will be shows that will fly. What kind of subscriber progression you can associate with a hit show? Who knows? That's all that you figure out only in hindsight. So it is a gamble. It is a risk. But I don't know how it unfolds.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm very looking forward to it on how it kind of unleashes itself. Plus, now Hotstar obviously has deeper pockets than it had earlier, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, in terms of getting in Fox.
Yeah, Rupert Murdoch. Yeah, no, they have deep pockets as well. I mean, probably deeper than the other guys here.
Yeah.
So, definitely they can make the right noise. But there's Amazon Prime Video as well.
Yeah.
They have deep pockets as well.
Right.
I
mean, Fox might be looking at like Hotstar as a domestic-focused OTT platform with original programming. And they obviously have something on HBO going on in the US, which is again original programming, putting it on an OTT platform
as
well.
Yeah, yeah. And Hotstar has different rights in different countries. I know Hotstar is there in Canada also. I think they have cricket rights there.
Oh, okay.
But they are looking overseas as well to, you know, make themselves heard.
Right.
But obviously, its flagship presence is in India.
Right.
And Star being a very key component to it. But let's see how that unfolds. And coming back to your Jet Airways stock chart, I would encourage people to look at the Netflix stock chart and hit max on the same way you hit for Jet Airways. It's a good looking chart.
Yeah, it's a good looking chart. I think Netflix, Amazon, those are very nice
upward sloping smooth curves.
Yeah. And that's a totally different kind of, that's a shareholder story there, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
At the end of the day. Well, very, very diverse discussion as usual. And, you know, in terms of other things going on, I was reading recently that even there were some numbers in from Germany, right? Biggest country or most economically significant country in the European Union.
And
it reported a slowest GDP rate in 5 years.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, potential slowdown in Germany, potential slowdown in China. And U.S. potential slowdown in U.S. stock market, but economy is apparently still strong.
Yeah, it's very interesting U.S. right now. Like you say, the numbers seem to be all right, but the bond markets and the stock markets give a completely different picture. It's very unique. But yeah, but I see your point. There are some warning bells around.
Right. And considering in India, with the prices now stabilizing, people are also expecting a potential rate cut. So things are looking not as bad here.
Yeah, it seems like they're flipping. But let's see what the big thing for India, obviously, is the upcoming elections.
Yeah.
Let's see how that changes things. Markets will certainly react leading up to it and after it. But let's see.
So we started with a positive note on India and we are ending it on a positive note on India. Very, very patriotic. No wonder 26th January is coming close and we are getting in that spirit. Well, on that note, I think we can now sign off on this week's podcast. Obviously, I do invite all our listeners to share their exquisite and valuable feedback. Either through a rating or, you know, in a more qualitative ways. It will be very helpful for us to improve our podcast series. And yeah, have a great week. Have a great weekend. This is Nikhil Arora.
And this is Charles Tupran.
Signing off.